step right up. The show's about to begin. Forget your troubles and raise your cups. Here's to this moment, it will never happen again.
This is Offstage and On the Air, performance number 631. I'm your host for today, Lisa Sheps. I am operating alone and without Annette. You are listening to us on KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby, streaming live at koop.org. Stay with us.
Hurry, hurry, step right up. The show's about to begin. Forget your troubles and raise your cup. Step right up.
I could have danced all night and still have begged for more. I could have spread my...
It is Wednesday, August 25th. We are back in the studio, folks. On the show today, we have Ground Floor Theater and the playwright of Rainfall Special on Me, Lane Michael Stanley, talking about the show that opens tomorrow night at Ground Floor Theater. Later on, we'll be talking to John Reedy of the Austin Creative Alliance, who will tell us about cultural contracting here in the city. And of course, I will have news with all of you of theater in Austin, New York, Baytown, and Points South. Stay with us.
All night.
Oh, my, my, my. This is Lisa Sheps. I am back in the studio. It has been a long time. So I need my listeners to forgive me for being rusty at how I do things here. Although so far it's been going swimmingly. I'm here in the studio at the airport studios here at KOOP. Thrilled to be back. Thrilled to be actually live on the microphone. I will throw this out. I don't typically do this, but if you wanted to call in while we're talking, I'd put you right on the air. 512-472-5665. I would do that. Why not? Well, let me just say, I think I would do that. I want to thank Kim Simpson, another wonderful international folk bazaar. I always love listening to Kim Simpson. I was in the lobby earlier talking to Max here at the station and how much we enjoy Kim Simpson's show. So it's nice to be able to thank him again. When we were pre-recording, of course, we assumed we'd be following Kim, but you never know. So we never really got to thank him all that much. We were listening to I Could Have Danced All Night. That's a recording by Peggy Lee on a album that she did about with Latin music. And I did that specifically because my lovely co-host, Nicole Shiro, who you are not hearing today, she is in New York because her Aunt Mimi passed away this weekend or past few days ago, and she's at the funeral. And that was one of Mimi's favorite songs. I decided not to go from the Broadway version. I decided to take a little different version, have a little bit of a flair to it, because Aunt Mimi had a flair about her. I never met her, but I feel like I had, because Nicole talks about her all the time. So Godspeed, Aunt Mimi. Godspeed to Nicole and the whole family up there as they're dealing with this incredible loss. So I'm so sorry about that. Let's talk about theater, shall we? And again, it's been so long since I've done this in the studio. You know, we've pre-recorded, so I'm able to control the time and everything. So who knows what's going to happen? But because we're dealing with a lot of landmarks right now, we've got to understand that we have a Broadway landmark. Last week, oh God, what day did it open? I think it opened Wednesday. I think it was a week ago. That Passover opened in New York, the very first Broadway show, if you don't include Bruce Springsteen's show, which I don't, it opened on Broadway. So we have a show open on Broadway, and we have some 17 that are going to open next month. And this show, like all other shows coming up, have the requirement of wearing masks, and they are requiring vaccinations. And I think that's really, really important to do, especially right now. And so lots of places here locally are starting to require vaccinations. Anyway, Antoinette Chinonwe Nwango's Passover opened, and it was a major success, raves across the board. And this is a show that opened, that played in Chicago at the Steppenwolf, and then off-Broadway before the pandemic. And now it's the first show to open post-pandemic. And I will say that post-pandemic, the next, I guess, six plays that are opening are all done by Black playwrights. So that's something to look forward to. We've talked about that on this show as well. So I'm going to start off by talking about Charles Isherwood's review, because, you know, I used to love me some Charles Isherwood when he was at the New York Times. He's no longer there. So I'm going to honor him by looking at his review first when we're talking about this. But he says that Passover feels almost momentous, even historic. And that is true. And not only because it's the first show to open this season, but there's a lot about this show that is historic. Since we closed down, we've had the murder of George Floyd and all of the diversity acknowledgement of the strife of BIPOC artists. And that's all been going on. So it's really good to know that we have a bunch of Black playwrights opening up. So anyway, one of the things he wrote that I really love, he says, is holding up a dark funhouse mirror to the brutal extremes of Black lives, Nwandu's play transcends its theatrical form to become a poetic meditation that almost defies classification. And that's true. And I will, before I say more, I should say that this was directed both in Chicago, off-Broadway, and now on Broadway by Dania Taymor, who I believe is the niece or the cousin to Julie Taymor, the genius behind Lion King and others. So it's really an amazing piece. And I will tell you that you have the opportunity to see the Steppenwolf version. It is streaming on, oh my gosh, I think it is streaming on Prime, and it is well worth seeing. It basically talks about two Black men that are clinging to this this intersection where there's a street light because they're afraid to leave that area for fear of being shot by the popo. That's their words. And it's very reminiscent, and in fact, it's based on Waiting for Godot, and it's got that same kind of thing. Instead of the tree, it's got a streetlight. So it's really, really wonderful. And it's really, it stars three people, the two Black men and then another, a white character who plays a character named Master and a character named Ossifer. And it, once Master enters, it just takes a whole bizarre level. So I will read this from Charles Isherwood's review. He says, this leads to one of the most chilling moments as they spar over the use of the N-word, resulting in an outburst from Master that encapsulates an underlying theme of the play, that the world belongs to the white man and Black people only have the right to live on the fringes and pray for the day they can pass over to some mythical promised land. And it really sort of talks about the plight of the Black person in today's society. So I think that that's well worth checking out on YouTube. The New York Times, Jesse Green also reviewed it. And let's see what he has to say. I got to follow my notes. I'm actually using a computer, which is crazy for me. The two characters are Moses and Kitch. Moses is played by John Michael Hill. Kitch is played by Namir Smallwood. And Master and Ossifer are played by Gabriel Ebert. And it's pretty interesting. One of the things they say, so Passover is a 90-minute play without intermission, and that is the official preference of Offstage and On the Air. We like the 90-minute shows without intermission. But in the playbill, it says that if Moses and Kitch can't leave, neither can you. They're talking to the audience, which I think that's kind of clever. So One of the things I wanted to talk about is we had heard during the pandemic and during the shutdown that Nwandu had changed the ending. And after I watched the Steppenwolf piece, I said to myself, oh my God, how could they possibly change this ending? The ending was so powerful. I didn't see how they could possibly do it. Evidently, they did, and they made it really, really well. I'm not going to give anything away, but if you watch the Amazon version, you can see, you will know that if you go to see it on Broadway, you'll see a different ending. I will read this from Jesse Green's review about the last 10 minutes. He says, it lets its innate surrealism fully flower in a daring, self-consciously theatrical way. The transformation is gorgeously rendered in Wilson Chin's scenic design, Marcus Doshi's lighting, Justin Ingleton's sound, and even in the removal, Serafina Bush's costumes. I guess that gives a little bit of way. So I also found it interesting that Bill Irwin, according to Isherwood, is one of the coordinators or choreographers. Let's see what some of the other critics had to say about this show. Matt Windham at AM New York said it's an enigmatic, experimental, divisive, and racially conscious work, the kind of show that rarely ever plays Broadway. The Wrap's Robert Hoffler said Wilson Chin's wasteland set and Marcus Doshi's startling lighting design contribute mightily to the suspense. And finally, Helen Shaw of Vulture said anyone who has seen Nwandu's work knows there's a combustible quality to her writing. It was almost frightening to be in the audience so full of open flames. Just amazing. Well worth seeing if you get to New York, but definitely if you don't, I would truly suggest checking out the Prime version. I also want to play something. So we're talking about coming back, and To Kill a Mockingbird is another one of those shows that's coming back. So I want to play a little promo they have, and you can see it on YouTube. There'll be a link at offstageonair.com. But let's just listen to that right now.
You remember what it was like before we had to turn the lights off?
Good evening, company.
This is your half-hour call.
This is your half-hour call.
Company,
half-hour to curtain.
You could have gone a lot of places, and you could have done a lot of things. But you did this, and you came here.
15 minutes, cast and crew. This is your 15-minute call for the top of Act 1.
And this is what you came for. The moment the house lights went down, and you and 1,000 strangers felt the same chill.
This is your 5-minute call, 5 minutes until the top of Act 1.
And we've been without it too long. But come this fall.
Company,
this is your places
call. This is places. Places, please, for Act 1.
Places, please.
We're turning the lights back on. These are the houses of the greatest storytellers in the world. It's here that a song can lift you off the ground. Here that a scene can put you on the edge of your seat. Here where a single moment can bring tears to your eyes, put a lump in your throat, or make you feel a foot taller. And it's here where a simple invocation will make you shiver.
Checking in, lights.
Standing by.
Sound.
Sound is standing by.
Automation.
Stage right.
I have places stage right.
Stage left.
I have places stage left.
You have the house. All right, company. We have the house. Have a great show. And welcome back.
All rise.
That's just a really beautiful piece done. And of course, you probably recognize that voiceover. That was Jeff Daniels. Again, the video is really great to watch. It shows a little bit of how the sausage is made in theater, in that you see the stage manager. And of course, listeners to this program know that I love stage managers because I used to be one. There you go. So we had another opening that is of note, but it happened across the pond in the UK. Andrew Lloyd Webber's Cinderella finally opened. Oh my God, it was so many times to try to open, and it didn't. It was in previews, I believe, before the shutdown, and then it was set to open in July of this year, and then a cast member got COVID, and of course, England got mired in a lot of Delta variant, and it kept closing and kept scheduling an opening, and then and had to postpone and postpone. Finally opened, and so everybody was probably thinking, and I know I was thinking, and I will say, and it's probably no secret for listeners of this program, that I'm not a big fan of Lloyd Webber, unless it's Joseph, which I like Joseph, and of course Jesus Christ Superstar, which both Nicole Shiro and I really, really love. I'm just going to take a quick tangential moment to say, oh God, Nicole, I miss you. I have to talk all by myself. That's all I want to say. But again, Godspeed to you. Rave reviews for this Cinderella, and it's not the Cinderella you are thinking of. I mean, it's based on the story Cinderella, but it's not Brandy's Cinderella. It's not Julie Andrews' Cinderella. It's certainly not Leslie Ann Warren's Cinderella. It's not Rodgers and Hammerstein. It's Andrew Lloyd Webber. And so this is a different story. And it opened last Wednesday, a week ago today, at the Gillian Lynn Theatre in Great Britain, in England. It's directed by Lawrence Connor. And we've heard pieces of the score before here on this program. I've played it. I know I played it. I think it's called Bad Cinderella that we played here a few weeks ago. Yep, Bad Cinderella. So here's the story and how it operates a little bit differently. Prince Charming, who is the prince in the regular Cinderella, doesn't really fall into this version except later. But this happens after the death of Prince Charming, and his brother is the one that takes over. And he happens to be a childhood friend of Cinderella. And the fairy godmother is a plastic surgeon that makes her look better for the show. But lots of things happen. I would encourage you to go look at the Wikipedia plot summary. It'll tell you how it happens. But one of the things that happens at the end that I kind of think is fun, Prince Charming comes back. He actually didn't die. He faked his death so he could run away and marry a man who he was in love with. And then he was welcomed back into the family, and everybody lived happily ever after. So that is Cinderella. It got great reviews. I'm going to guess it's going to come over here at some point. But we're going to take a quick little break. We're going to listen to a little bit of Cinderella. And we're going to listen to the song called Unfair. We'll be right back.
You took my purple brooch.
I like it. It's an amethyst.
I'll give it back right now before
we are back. And I want to remind everybody, we are live and in the studio. I'm actually sitting in front of a microphone talking to you, speaking I'm doing it off the cuff. I can't get rid of little fluffs like that. There's no editing anymore. So we're back. Happy to be here, and we're thrilled to be live in the studio. I'm going to go to our first guest, who is Lane Michael Stanley, who's the playwright of Rainfall Special on Me, opening tomorrow night at Ground Floor Theater in full transparency. Ground Floor Theater is the theater that I run itself, but it's a wonderful play, and it is the reopening of Ground Floor Theater, and that is tomorrow night. So let's just listen to that interview with Lane Michael Stanley, and here it is. I am here with the playwright of Rainfall Special on Me, Lane Michael Stanley, who's going to talk to us a little bit about the show that's about to open at Ground Floor Theater. Welcome back to the show, Lane.
Hi, thank you.
So I'm really happy to have you on the show. I have to just mention to folks, with last time we saw Lane was during Transom, also at Ground Floor Theater, where he was part of our team in this Devise piece. And this is a play that we read, God, right when we first met you years ago and decided we wanted to do it. It's called Rainfall Special on Me. Tell us a little bit about the play, Lane.
Sure. So Rainfall Special on Me is about a group of chronically homeless folks who stay dry behind the theater when it rains. That's kind of the headline. But basically, you know, it's people from very different backgrounds who are on the street for very different reasons. I think it's a kind of slice of life window into that experience.
Right. I like to call it, I kind of call it a found family, because when you look at it, they are very much with all the benefits and pitfalls of being in a family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a wide range in the web of relationships, and some people are definitely closer than others, which I think can, I think for me, whenever I feel, I hear chosen family, I think of people who have really chosen each other, and I don't like that. And you didn't say chosen, you said found, but I think chosen family doesn't apply, right? Because you kind of, in situations like this, end up with the people who were there, which is maybe a little bit more like our actual families, is that you are stuck with certain people. So, yeah, that resonates in certain ways.
So I don't think you and I have ever talked about this. What was your impetus to actually write this piece?
Sure. So I actually started with a different piece called The Tiny Banger that we did at Trinity Street Players a couple years back. So I lived in a recovery house for 6 months in 2016 after my fiance died for drug and alcohol recovery. And while I was there, I lived with a lot of folks who were coming in from the street, coming in from prison, et cetera. And in 2018, I guess, a few years ago now, basically was watching Charlie Chaplin movies and looking at the tramp archetype, and was got very taken with societal perceptions of poverty and how different they are from now from the tramp archetype. And so basically asked what would happen if we put like a modern day heroin addict into the Charlie Chaplin tramp world. And as I continued researching, I realized that like the highest stakes of this question of societal perceptions of poverty is around criminalization of homelessness, because we have all of these laws like camping bans and panhandling bans and loitering bans that are really just about getting homelessness out of sight. And so that's where these perceptions matter the most, right? When laws end up trapping people in certain cycles, are not intended to help people experiencing homelessness, or just intended to make it kind of go away and be less visible. And so that play that we did at Trinity, that was very much about barriers to housing, about how these criminalization laws trap people in cycles of incarceration that make it impossible to hold down work, and thus impossible to get housed. And as we were performing that play, we did a tour to different homeless resource centers. We had a lot of open rehearsals. We had a lot of conversations with folks. I was hearing over and over, "That's why I'm not trying to get housed." And I was hearing a lot of perspectives of people who, in one way or another, had chosen or accepted that they were living on the street and were not in a position of trying to change that. And so it became a question of looking at like, what are the other options when that choice gets made? What are the faculties that choice gets made with? And so Rain is really exploring that question of why do people stop trying to get housed? Another way of phrasing that would be, why do people choose to live on the street? But I think that can be really a loaded way of saying that.
Right. And choose might not be the right word either.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Choose implies, you know,
that there are other options.
Exactly. I can choose between a lot of options on a menu. Sure. But there's also, you know, a lot of beautiful things that people will talk about, of the joy of sleeping outside, that human animals are not meant to be living in cages, that society is broken and flawed and they don't want a part in it, which I can certainly understand. You know, so it's been a balance kind of showing the traumas and difficulties that can lead to that being the only good choice, and showing what the positives are of why somebody might make that choice and how they might benefit from that kind of lifestyle. So it's a balancing act always.
Sure. And I actually think it's interesting. I think people do a lot of good, especially those that judge negatively people experiencing homelessness, to actually go out and see it. I was part of the Census Bureau's homeless count, and we went into all the camps, and with the exception of one time, I had someone who was a little aggressive, didn't want to talk to us, mainly because we just kept bothering them. But these camps were amazing. They were little homesteads. It kind of made me want to be there, but then I, you know, if I really think about it, no. But the other thing that that I find interesting, just in today's environment, I believe you wrote this before, while there was the restrictions, there was the illegality of loitering, and then we passed the law a couple of years ago here in town, making it legal, which the state has been fighting over the past 2 years, and finally won that fight at the last election. So we're now back to criminalizing people experiencing homelessness. So how do you feel about your piece being as so integrated into Austin's story right now?
Yeah, I think it's, and a lot of that has happened, I think, since I kind of finished the play. And it's complicated too, because I've just said it's set in 2019, for COVID reasons. That's just not an element that we have room to deal with without it completely taking over the play. And so kind of as a consequence of that too, that places us in a certain point in Austin's laws. I mean, in some ways it's good that these things are fluctuating, because at least they're on the table of discussion, right? Obviously we wish they were going the positive direction. But hopefully I think these, plays like this can humanize. And so, like, I think that people will think of encampments like that as just being blight, and they don't think of it as somebody's home. And we have a situation where, like, when in the play, where as somebody, all of their belongings get rolled, get taken away. And it's like somebody picks up your entire house and just it's gone, And so, like, hopefully that can help understand that, like, it's not just trash, you know what I mean? Like, there's a human being that lives there. It's a much bigger, more emotional project to clear that stuff out than you're maybe thinking.
Yeah. Well, so in our last minute or so, I'm going to have to ask the unfair question, because, every parent who has children is asked who their favorite is. So you've got six characters here that all are different and all have different variables of likedness and not likedness. And do you have a favorite character in the show?
Oh, Snake is my favorite character. Well, yeah. Maybe I'm a bad parent because I'm too ready to answer that question.
Well, Snake is a fun character. And I don't know if fun is the right. Well, yeah, actually, I will say he is a fun character, and certainly has a great name.
Do you have a favorite character?
I actually like Motor an awful lot. I mean, I think mainly because if I were going to play somebody in this show, I would want to play that role, because
yes.
I don't want to give anything away, but Motor is a free spirit.
That would be the right choice to cast you. I would support that.
Well, great. Lane Michael Stanley, thank you for coming back on Offstage and on the Air. And I know you're in Los Angeles now, but we hope that you make frequent trips back here to Austin, Texas.
Thank you so much. Excited to see you in the show soon.
Well, there you go. You saw a little bit of how the sausage was made. I was supposed to edit a piece out, and then I didn't. Shame on me. Rainfall Special on Me plays August 26th. That's tomorrow through September 3rd at Ground Floor Theater. For more information, you can go to groundfloortheater.org/rain. We'll be right back.
Sunshine, blue skies, please go away.
What a beautiful, beautiful song. That is I Wish It Would Rain from Ain't Too Proud, The Life and Times of the Temptations, on Broadway. I believe it's not open yet, but I'm pretty sure it plans to. Once again, that was I Wish It Would Rain from Ain't Too Proud, The Life and Times of the Temptations. So some of the other stuff we wanted to talk about, and I think it's apropos to talk about it here, there was a, oh my gosh, I'm going to come up with it. All the theater companies, and the Broadway League and Actors Equity signed a, pledge that was based on the, Broadway. Oh my God, I am Black Theater United. I'm so sorry. I'm so tongue-tied. I'm not used to doing this live anymore, folks. I'll stop making that excuse soon, but maybe not. Maybe I'll just keep going. Anyway, Black Theater United came up with a list of demands, or a not demands, but a system, putting systems in place for racial equity in theater, as we've all known from We See You White Theater and other things. There's a lot of work that the white theater community or the theater community needs to do in general. But one of the things that they pledged to do that I thought was very telling and wonderful is they pledged to never again to have an all white production team. That is so important. And this was again signed by all 41 Broadway theaters, the Broadway League, Actors Equity Association. Notably, it did not include unions like IATSE or AFM, the Musicians Union, which is historically much more white organizations, and they're trying to find a way where they can feel like they can sign on to the pledge. But I think it's pretty amazing that this is happening, and let's make sure that we are all, as we've been since George Floyd's murder, we've all been walking the walk. We've all been talking the talk. Let's see if we can't start walking the walk a little bit more. And I'm proud of them for doing that. And that's that. Speaking of Hamilton, were we talking of Hamilton? We were. Hamilton opened at the Pantages Theater in Los Angeles. Now, the Pantages was closed for 523 days. I believe that Hamilton was just beginning or just about to start performances in March of 2020 when they got shut down. So they've been out for 523 days. So they opened up again. I don't see what night they did it. They do require vaccines to go. And it was roughly, they had 2,700 people sitting shoulder to shoulder, as I like to say, trading energy with those actors on stage. And, you know, that's amazing energy that those folks from Hamilton have. And what I loved is they interviewed this young girl who just couldn't wait to see it. And she couldn't wait to see it because she got spurred to see it live by watching it on TV on the Disney Channel. So I think that goes a lot to talk about what Nicole and I have talked about a lot, which is that streaming Broadway or making it available for more people via places like the internet and streaming services won't cannibalize ticket sales from the plays, because I think it will make people want to go more than ever. They said, so this was a very exciting as they were ushering people in. The ushers were, everybody was getting into the groove and everybody was very happy to have people in. In this article from the Los Angeles Times, it says, at each entrance to the house, ushers greeted guests like they were Thomas Jefferson arriving at the top of Act Two. There you are, one usher beamed as a group of four approached their tickets. We've missed you. How have you been? I just love the whole feel of coming back into the theater, sitting side by side, shoulder to shoulder with other people, and enjoying a theatrical venture, which is something that just you just can't get anywhere. Okay, we of course are running out of time. I want to talk about this article about the case for Grosses. I think we mentioned that after Bruce Springsteen opened, producer said they were not going to give out the grosses as they have every week forever, actually. So now they're saying that they have the league has confirmed that they won't report grosses for the entire of the 21-22 season. They think they might go for the 22-23, but a lot of us think that they probably aren't, because it many times is a harbinger for the end of some shows as grosses come down. And it's not always accurate. But this article, which is from theatrally.com, and it was written by Joey Simpson, came out on August 16th, says that it's a responsibility to publish the grosses. They say, Bill Haber said, if you're not willing to publish financial data on your industry, you're not an industry. You're a hobby. You're not an industry. You're a hobby. Actually, that was said by Ken Davenport in a blog post in 2009. You can compare all this data with other seasons. There's lots of reasons to have to advertise the grosses, and advertise isn't the word, to publish the grosses. So let me read the last paragraph of Joey Sims' article. He says, quote, no one knows what lies ahead. We only know that it's going to be a tough path for everyone. Yet the road to theater recreating itself as something fairer, better, and more equitable has to mean more openness, not less. Information that will benefit everyone should not be restricted to those, quote, in the know. Transparency is the only path to shared understanding across the industry of the challenges ahead. How can we face them, and how long this is going to take? I think that's an important thing to say, that I'm hoping that the Broadway League decides to bring the grosses back. And I want to make sure that I have time. And I do. I'm just going to do this right now because we're running out of time. There's a lot of stuff I didn't want to do, or I wanted to do that I wasn't able to. I will say that Annie Live, God is Annie. Annie Live is going to play December 2nd live on NBC. But here's, it's been a long time in coming, but here is today in theater history. Yay! We haven't had today in theater history for a long time because we were pre-recorded and we couldn't do today. But now we can. So in 1918, it is the birth of one Leonard Bernstein. He did lots of shows, but things like Candide, Wonderful Town, On the Town, and West Side Story. It is his birthday. Bon anniversaire, Leonard Bernstein. 1980. This is very interesting. This was the opening of 42nd Street. I will never forget this. I believe this is one of the more infamous things that David Merrick ever did. He was the famous producer, or I would like to call him infamous producer. I found he operated in ways that I would not necessarily call the most ethical. But 42nd Street opened. It starred Jerry Orbach, Tammy Grimes, Wanda Reichert, and Leroy Reams. At the curtain call, after the cast took their first bows and everybody was cheering, he ran out on stage to announce the death of, of Gower Champion, who choreographed it. Gower Champion passed away earlier that day, and he waited till the curtain call to say it. And I think that was just a big publicity stunt, and I am not happy about it. But there it goes. He's very famous for doing that. Gower Champion choreographed shows like Bye Bye Birdie, Hello Dolly, and Sugar. I would like to point out that there is a documentary on great performances about Broadway. I forgot the full title of it, but it talks about this evening as well, amongst other things. Like, it told the whole story of Chorus Line. It's an amazing documentary. Go find it on Great Performances. Well worth seeing and spending an hour and a half of your time. So let's take a little break. Let's listen to a little bit from 42nd Street. I'm sure you'll recognize this song. It's 8:45.
The stars are gonna twinkle and shine this evening about 8:45.
We are back. You're listening to Offstage and On the Air on KOOP 91.7 FM. We've had such a wonderful time talking here to you live. We have one more interview to get to. Many of you may know that Cultural Contracts from the Cultural Arts Division at the City of Austin, there's been a lot of talk about how the funding is changing and how every everything is changing. And so I spent some time talking to John Reedy of the Austin Creative Alliance about some of those changes that are coming up and some of the things that some folks think need to be done. Here, let's listen to that interview. Well, we're here with John Reedy of the Austin Creative Alliance to talk about city funding, which has been very prevalent in the discussions in the theater community here in Austin, Texas, because the City of Austin cultural contracts have been somewhat controversial and continue to be so. So, John, welcome to Offstage and On the Air.
Hey, thanks for having me, Lisa.
So let's just talk about where we are. I mean, typically prior to COVID, many theater companies, actually, not just theater, that's what I'm interested in, but cultural organizations got a great deal of their funding through the City of Austin that was funded by the hotel occupancy tax. Obviously, since COVID, the hotel occupancy tax has been decreased, but also they're going through a major overhaul of how and who gets funded. Can you talk to us a little bit about that as succinctly as you can? What's going on?
Starting around 2018, there were a lot of new applicants into the cultural arts funding program, and that meant that the money was spread a little more thinly, which resulted in cuts to some longtime contractors. And there was an outcry around that, and that prompted the beginning of what we're in right now, which is the cultural funding review process. And that cultural funding review process has resulted in some proposed guidelines from the city that would be pretty drastic change to the system that's been in place for decades. So as you might imagine, people are paying close attention, and there's a lot of concern around these changes.
So why have they implemented these changes, or what are they telling us?
The changes are meant to comply with the City Council's Strategic Direction 2023. And one of those components is about taking all city programs, looking at all city programs through a lens of equity.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's specifically racial equity, correct?
That's right. Yeah, sorry. Racial equity. And so these new proposed guidelines are meant to address historical inequities in the city's cultural funding programs.
Now, on the surface, that sounds really good. So I know that they have been proposing three different funding buckets, if you will. And the majority, the bulk of the previous contractors sat in that middle bucket, which they have said they are not funding for probably at least 2 years.
Yes, the bulk of existing contractors would fall into this program named Elevate, but they've said that due to lack of funds, they don't plan to fund Elevate until possibly fiscal year 24. So we're about to embark into fiscal year 22. So that would be two more funding cycles with a large number of organizations not receiving city support.
Right. And one could think that, I know when we listen to what they say that the hotel occupancy tax won't get itself back to, and I'm using air quotes, normal until 2025. So by that dint, you would think that it might even be 3 years before the bulk of people see funding, regardless of what happens from an equitable standpoint.
Right.
That's a tough pill for a lot of us to swallow. They're also saying that they have $3 million. And I know there's some question about how much money they actually have. I know there were some rescue funds that were diverted for cultural, not necessarily for cultural contracting, which is what we're talking about, but for the cultural arts division, which hasn't done some $3 or $4 more million that hasn't been earmarked and how it would be spent. How does all that play together in the same sandbox?
Well, the community was really successful in lobbying for additional resources last year. And then staff chose to, at the same time, move to an accrual method of paying. Basically, like, let's save a bunch of money so we can spend actual money on hand rather than projected hotel taxes, which makes a lot of sense because your projections, as we saw, fall short with things like pandemics. I think the surprise came to the community is that there was about $7.7 million available, almost $8 million available, and staff has said they are only going to spend three of it on contracts, about 600,000 of it on admin, and put almost 4.3 million into this reserve to begin moving towards spending actuals rather than projected. And that's a great idea to move in that direction. But, you know, it was a surprise to people that over half of the available funds wouldn't be spent in this time of desperate need. And we did advocate for that move to actuals versus proposed projected to happen over several years rather than all at once. But we were not successful in that.
Well, also, and the timing seems a little strange in that, you know, as you said, historically, they've always used an estimated what they thought the hotel occupancy tax would be. And so it makes sense to go to actuals. But now when so many people are hurting, is this the right time to make that move?
Right. I think that's worth discussing. And we're still talking about that with City Council. And we're hoping for maybe a budget amendment that might move more resources towards the arts. So, yeah, it is a question of timing. It's not a question of whether moving to actuals is a bad idea. It's just, is it a great idea to do it all at once right now?
So, I mean, this is a really complex issue with where the money comes from. I know there's statutory reasons through the state where the money for cultural contracts specifically has to come through the hotel occupancy tax currently. And there is all the money, the rescue funds that were there. And so there's a lots of different, very complex things that probably
so many
only
moving parts.
Yeah. So only you understand. But let's talk about and we don't have a whole bunch of time to discuss it. But What I know that the cultural contracting agreements and the way we're doing things isn't set in stone. And they've been telling the theater community that, or the cultural community that, for a while, although they continue to see going on the same direction, even though they say it's not done yet. But in reality, it isn't done yet. Is there anything, is there anything that the community could do to change things up or to get that Elevate piece to be funded a little bit so that some of the people that have historically been funded can get maybe, you know, a little, because it's going to hurt a lot of people. And if you're not funded for a few years, that can really be devastating to your organization.
Yeah. You know, I think there's one thing that folks can do is ACA has a survey. We just started AustinCreativeAlliance.org/survey. Which is just going to gather quantitative data about how the arts community feels, you know, how the city's doing their job with the cultural community. Be great to get more people to fill that out. But in a practical way, you know, if you look at, so we looked at the contract for the consultant who's running the cultural review funding review process. And if you look at that contract, it outlines a really robust data-driven process. But that's not the experience that we've seen in the community. There hasn't been a lot of community engagement. We haven't seen a lot of data, both a starting point data, like data showing where the actual inequities lie, not just in terms of like Black organizations get X, Latino get X, White get X, but there's so much more complexity within that, especially taking into account diversity. And so when an organization is not culturally specific, like say the Vortex or yours or mine, but we do have a diverse board and we serve diverse audiences and we employ diverse creators, that's not taken into account at all in the city's proposals. So that's where I think we need to get active and tell, you know, the Arts Commission, the City Council, and the staff itself that our community is diverse. The ecosystem is intertwined in many ways, and they need to take into account through their equity lens, a look at how different organizations have shown their commitment to equity. You know, if you're a white led, 100% white board organization that serves a white audience, that's probably something I wouldn't support continuing to fund. But if you're a white-founded organization with 30 years of anti-racism and equity under your belt, and many, many BIPOC artists use your space, that should be taken into account. And currently it's not.
Okay. And I will just argue that the city might argue that this is about funding organizations that are BIPOC-led versus BIPOC-serving. So I'll just throw that out there, that's their stated intention, is to help companies that have traditionally not been left out, but had hurdles that they may have found difficult to go through to get city funding.
And that's super important to grow BIPOC-led organizations for sure. But we can't forget that many BIPOC artists use spaces that exist not through BIPOC-led organizations. And also they haven't really defined leadership. So my board chair is a Black person. A lot of boards are more diverse than maybe the founder of their company is. So it's really like, let's take the, and that's what the consultant's contract describes, but we haven't seen it, a deep dive into the demographics of the ecosystem and who's serving who and how. You can do that and still prioritize BIPOC-led organizations. Just don't cut out diverse organizations entirely.
Great. Well, John, thanks. So where can folks go to get information and learn how they can get involved in this? And if I'm assuming you know, if they want to write to the city council, do you have links for that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I would go to austincreativealliance.org/advocacy and sign up for our advocacy list where we put out regular updates. You can also go to the Arts Commission page at the City of Austin, just Google City of Austin Arts Commission. And again, take our survey so that we can deliver those metrics to the city council, and we can show the city council how the community feels about the process.
And people can easily find that survey on your website at the advocacy tab.
AustinCreativeAlliance.org/survey is going to get you directly there, but you can Google around. I mean, you can kind of meander around.
You can find it.
I would just say AustinCreativeAlliance.org/survey is your best bet.
Awesome. Well, John, thanks for filling us in. We always love having you on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's good seeing you. Take care.
Good seeing you.
Okay. Well, that's all you need to know about cultural contracting. Well, it's been a fun show being back on the air. I hope you appreciate hearing a little bit more of a, well, we're always kind of laid back and shooting from the hip kind of show, but this was truly shooting from the hip because I have not performed live for a very long, long time. So, but you have done it. This is another hour of Offstage and On the Air. Next week, we'll be back with Nicole. Nicole will be joining us by phone, and we'll have more stuff next week when we look at what's happening offstage and on air. Now we're going to go out with a song from RNAP the Musical, which stands for Rob and Anita Podcast. And this song is called Nicole and Mara Sing the Blues. We'll see y'all next week.
How y'all doing today? My name's Nicole, and that's Mara. We've been feeling pretty blue lately. That's all because of our husbands. So this song goes out to our husbands wherever they are tonight.